Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays to everyone.
Happy, happy everywhere. I wish I could just spread happiness the way my dad and I used to spread manure on the farm. Because it made the plants very happy.
That's right.
Yeah. So, the first thing I'd like to talk about today is the former darlings of the stock market are now among the major shrinkers. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's really... you know, not at all surprising, when you look at the amount of appreciation that went on in the stock market from the 2020 March bottom into early 2022. Like the appreciation, not just in stocks, but in housing and in corporate debt and all kinds of crypto and every manner of asset that was available to have cash thrown at it, was really off the charts. And that was nothing to do with fundamentals or anything that was sustainable or revenue growth or anything of that. It was just speculative fever and free money flowing throughout. So when we see that kind of those kind of bubbles burst, the reversion to the downside is often shocking to people. But really, if you pull back, it's not even accomplished that much in the big picture. Again, relative to where we were in 2020, before the bubble sort of really went parabolic, or 2019, we're starting to see things really just come back to where they were even a couple of years ago. So, and at that point, the valuations on many assets were already too high or unattractive, were you know, not very investment grade. And so the parabolic move, as I say, in the last couple of years really made that worse. So now as you've seen the mean reversion kick in, it's pretty breathtaking to behold, but it's, you know, shouldn't really be that surprising to people. I mean, just, you know, if you look at something like Tesla, which is one of the shares, we were talking about that company last time, but one of the shares that has come off significantly, you know, more than 63%, from its peak. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about, is that because, you know, Elon Musk has been doing things in the news that are upsetting people or anything like that? He's been tweeting lately that it's to do with the central banks and their increasing of rates and, you know, quantitative tightening and pulling liquidity out of the financial system. It certainly is to do with that. That's a lot of what's happening in the world right now with disappointing growth and also asset prices coming down. But what needs to be acknowledged in that conversation is that, you know, again, just taking Tesla as one example, there's so many that we could use for this, but from 2010 to 22, when central banks were doing all these, you know, consecutive iterations of quantitative easing and all this manipulation of the yield curve and all sorts of things they were doing to keep rates low and keep spending and borrowing going, you had, for example, Tesla revenues increased 28% during that period, but its shares rose by 743%. So my point would be that, you know, in the last couple of years, Tesla revenue has continued to grow, but shares have come off more than 60% just in the last year. So this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. When the disconnect is so great from the underlying business, from the financial prospects from the, you know, actual earnings growth, from the revenue growth, this sort of thing, from the sustainability of the of the company itself, then you know that you're into this bubble territory. So right now we've got, you know, the S&P was off just about 20% since January, since the start of January in 2022, and it's been off more than 6% month to date, which is actually extremely unusual to have the stock market fall that much in the month of December. We haven't seen something like that since sort of 2018, when it also, you know, the Fed was tightening back then, although at about a third of the pace that it's been tightening in 2022. So, you know, we had these, Apple's been the largest component of the major U.S. indices all along here for a long time. It's more than 6% of the S&P as an example. So whether people appreciate it or not, they are actually quite exposed to some of these big names. Even if they're in what's a so-called, you know, diversified portfolio that tends to track a benchmark index like the S&P, for example, they do have this overweight in some of these individual tech names. And as prices have been collapsing, we've seen a shifting of that guard. So the top five in the S&P today are, you know, number one is still Apple, but it's off about 27% from its peak. Microsoft is number two. It's about 5.6% of that index. It's off about 28%. And then Amazon is third. And the other companies in the indices, like Amazon's 2.4%, and then it goes down to Berkshire Hathaway 1.6 and Google 1.6. And from there, you get a much tinier fraction. So my point is that these larger positions still have a big sway in the overall index. They were part of why the index went up as much as it did on the free money speculation, that index tracking and that passive flows of funds, which, by the way, have continued in 2022. So we have not yet seen any retail capitulation on the stock side. We continue to see, although people, consumer sentiment is at, you know, multi-decade lows, and you see business sentiment at multi-decade lows, and you see, you know, people talking a good bearish game here, we've still had a net inflow of money into the stock market all year long in 2022. So people have been really conditioned through years of QE and ongoing, you know, reviving of the boom and the bubble, that they should buy the dip. And so they've been continuing to do that. Passive allocations into trend, you know, index tracking funds and ETFs is still the game of preference here. But actually, that's, you know, likely to change. These go in long cycles. And my point would be as well that when the selling does hit, and I still feel quite confident that we're going to get to a period where you do start to see capitulation. I think if we got a break to a lower low, from the June 12 low that was prior, if we break down further, perhaps it'll happen in January now, because we may get indeed some bounce into the year end. That would be highly normal, although on very light flows. But if we get some renewed selling pressure to continue, where names like Apple, which are still so widely held and widely overloved, if it was to fulfill its sort of full cycle destiny in past bear markets and fall sort of more than 50%, same with something like Microsoft, you know, those declines, those, you know, sort of doubling of its losses so far this cycle would really have an impact on the broad indices and bring everything down. So I think altogether, you know, we've had a very negative year in 2022, the worst one since 2008. But if you recall, the bottom wasn't in 2008. The bottom in the stock market actually came in 2009. And I think that in this case, the stock market may indeed find its bottom in 2023 potentially, or early 2024. And so I think people should be careful with, you know, the buy the dip mentality. And a lot of people still have very little cash. And even though cash has gone up in terms of a holding for most funds today, they consider 6% cash to be extremely defensive. And of course, that's very little help to anybody. Once prices have dropped, if you've only got 6% cash to redeploy, you really aren't going to get advantage of any clearance prices or buy, you know, buying on sale and that sort of thing. So I think all that really, it comes to say that we have to be very careful with these presumptions that because the S&P is down 20%, I mean, the TSX hasn't come off that much yet. It's late cycle because of its exposure to oil and gas in particular. But as that continues, you know, there's never been a recession where you didn't see a big decline in oil and gas prices. And I think that that will ultimately come back to pull the TSX down further. And then, of course, we have the potential contagion to the banking sector as we get into this housing downturn and defaults now rising.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, Canadian home prices down 12% year to year, 22% since February. What's our Canadian home prices? Are they going to continue to plunge? Are they going to pretty well stop around this point? Do you have any idea?
Well, I certainly would be very surprised if they stopped at this point. I mean, the momentum, again, looking back at what happened from the 2020, you know, pandemic when it began and what happened in Canadian home prices, in many areas they almost doubled over the following 2 years as interest rates were cut to all-time lows and free money was handed out on the fiscal side. So what you've now got is this mean reversion process. But, you know, even with the declines, and they are starting to rival some of the worst we've seen in past, you know, annual declines in past cycles, the Canadian single-family homes, of course, the volumes are plunging. But the prices themselves are off, you know, more than 10% in many regions, like in the Greater Toronto Area where I live, you know, the prices have come off from the February peak, which was February of 22 was the real, the absolute mania madness. Prices have come off from there, but on a year-over-year basis nationally, we're still just barely, we're still up a couple of percent. So although you've had this big drawdown since February, you know, if you look back to where we were a year ago, we're still slightly up on Canadian housing prices, nationally. In some areas it may be slightly negative, but we've really just kind of started into the correction process that's needed here. And if you look at things like rents, Canadian housing is still you know, obscenely valued relative to rents and relative to incomes. I was writing about this on the blog this week, but basically Canadian households now need, nationally more than 62.7% of the median household income just to cover their mortgage payments in November. That was the highest we've ever seen on that, and not even in the housing bubble peak of 1980 or 1990, which were both formidable housing bubbles that peaked at that point. Not even then, when mortgage rates were 14% and higher, did we have a greater proportion of household income needed just to make the mortgage payments. So the reasoning here is not actually to do with the increase in rates, which has been significant year to date, but relatively speaking, you know, the average variable rate mortgage right now is a 6.15%, a HELOC is 7.45%, but the thing that's different today is the principal portion, which of course, as I said, went up an astronomical amount during the housing bubble that we experienced nationally. And in certain cities like Vancouver, for example, you need the average household is needing more than 95% of their income just to service the mortgage. Well, clearly, people can't function or survive if 95% of their income is going to pay their mortgage and they have nothing literally left over for everything else that a family needs. And the math just doesn't make any sense. You know, like I was doing again some actual calculations to see where we're at in terms of the repricing cycle. But, you know, 89% of Canadians earn less than $100,000 annually. Just 1% of the population has an individual income, taxable income of more than $200,000 in the whole country. And when you look at that, so according to the CMHC calculator, a household with $100,000 in annual income, which is $833 a month and much more than the actual average income. Nationally, the median income is $75,000 per household. And in big cities, the highest population areas, it's in excess of 80,000 per household. So if we take even that really above median income of $100,000 annually, then, and you have no other debt, you can qualify for a mortgage payment of $2,800. So the thing is that that requires a maximum home price of about $580,000 today. That would be nearly six times $100,000 household income, which is historically about twice as much has been sort of sustainable. Sort of typically, and before this bubble that happened in the last decade, a housing cost that was about three times your household income was considered normal or reasonable, sustainable, that sort of thing. So even in the most, you know, above median household incomes, we're now more than six times to afford the median price. And the other problem being that the median sale price in Canada in November was actually $632,000. So that's almost $100,000 more than the median, you know, the above median income household can afford. So we're just nowhere near restoring any kind of reasonable metrics here. And I think that we should expect and hope that prices will continue to decline because it's so desperately needed to realign the economy with anything that's based on productivity or, you know, upward mobility or anything over the longer term. I was also looking at 1980s and 1990, which I remember, and you may do as well, Jim, but prices in Canada peaked in the third quarter of 1981, and they began to decline because the central bank was increasing interest rates at that point. We did in fact have a recession in 1980 and again in 1981-82. But housing prices peaked in the third quarter of 81. They troughed 3 years later, down 30-50% depending on the region that you were in. And it took till the second quarter of 1987 for homes in most regions to reclaim that 81 peak. So that's a 6 year cycle from the peak, you know, dropping 30-50% and then waiting several years to recover the prior high. So I think that's really a normal cycle. That's very typical to what we saw in the America after their peak in housing in 2006. And it would be entirely feasible that that's the kind of scenario. That would actually probably be a best case scenario given how extended and overvalued we became on that, on the price side. So the good news is it means that, you know, we can get back to households being able to afford a place to live. Rents are starting to come down. They've been falling now the past few months, which is again part and parcel of this increase in inventory that we'll be looking for. You know, if people can't don't want to immediately sell or can't sell, they will often look to rent. And we know that the institutional buyers that were 50% of those that were, you know, consuming houses in the 2021 period are now looking to sell because their funds are getting requests for redemption. So there's this cascading effect of liquidity and people wanting to get out of these negative carry properties. And the other point I was making, which I think is really important for people to think about, is that the higher the income bracket that a person has, the more debt they actually qualify for. Now, banks don't say it that way. They say that you're entitled to more credit. What that really means is, Jim, you're entitled to more debt if you want it. And so in these higher income areas, that's where you get the more, you know, increased leverage on everything. And we're starting to see that in all sorts of, you know, fancy cars coming up on the market. People have done insane things in the past couple of years, like buying, you know, high-end vehicles with, you know, payments that looked more like mortgage payments because, you know, they thought that, that rates were going to be low or that they'd be able to take funds out of their housing as a perpetual piggy bank. So you're seeing this glut of vehicles now coming onto the market looking for people to take over leases, you know, some like $2,000 and $3,000 a month payments, like just mind-boggling stuff. But this is typically in these higher income areas because obviously people with poorer incomes couldn't even begin to qualify for some of those payments. So And the other thing that we know during the past couple of years is that those higher income families were buying secondary properties, which means they had more than one mortgage, if not two, even more than that, you know, secondary funding on their primary residence to buy a second property and then have a mortgage on that. So that's why, you know, the pricing, the areas where the prices went up the most tend to be the most highly levered. And they're also the people who are losing now, you know, they're the 10% of the population that own these stocks that have all been coming back off. So this contagion effect really will affect the areas where prices went up the most, and the fancy cars and things were the most overbought as well. And you get this liquidation cycle where everyone's looking for cash and everything's coming on the market. I also noticed something interesting. Manhattan real estate sales were off 35% year to date in 2022. But the 10 million plus bracket was off 41%. So, you know, a lot of people have this mistaken idea that if you're in a rich area or if you're, you know, in these higher echelon properties, that they're somehow immune from this cycle. But in fact, that's completely the opposite, because they tend, as I said, to have high levels of credit levered off of these asset bubbles. And so that's the type of funding that evaporates very quickly, not just the low end.
Danielle, if you can give the crystal ball a good rub, what do you think is going to be the state of the economy in 2023?
Well, I think that we're going into a recessionary period. I think, you know, as certain as one can be about these things, all of the indicators suggest that's the case. I think unemployment will continue to rise. And it's possible that we could see central banks go on hold in their hiking efforts as early as, you know, January or March potentially. And then they may not hike rates for the rest of the period. That may be the peak of the cycle. But if that's the case, I still don't expect them to start cutting rates for some time, because I think they've been quite fearful of this whole inflationary episode. And then we run the risk that if they do start slashing rates too early, we could get a revival in inflation again, and something like what happened in the 1970s. So there was nothing really good that came out of that period. It was a very expensive chapter for everyone. Ultimately, it made a secular low in stocks, where valuations were crushed to about an 8 times price to earnings multiple by the secular low of 1982. I think the good news is that asset prices will continue to fall here, at least for the next year potentially. I don't expect central banks to look to cut rates until maybe this time next year, or potentially, depending on how bad the downturn goes and how much the unemployment rises, you may see them trying to do something on the easing side by the fall of 23. But typically you don't see a bottom in the stock market until after that. And now, again, speaking of, you know, the yield curves, we've had this global inversion of Treasury yield curves. That's unprecedented, pretty much, to the extent we've had it in 2022. But we ultimately don't get a bottom in the stock market until you get this rapid re-steepening phase. And what causes that is central banks cutting rates at the short end, where they drop, you know, right now the curve's inverted, where yields or interest rates on the short end are higher than those available on the long end. That's the bond market seeing the recession coming. Once central banks move to start finally cutting the short end rate, they re-steepen that curve. That dramatic re-steepening is what is a precursor to finally a stock market bottom. So I think, you know, we should, if you're able to hold on to your cash, if you're able to, you know, keep your employment, keep your expenses low, de-lever yourself in this environment, I think that we have the prospects of a challenging year in 23 if you're holding on to over-levered things, or if you have a hard time keeping your income. But if you can wait, I think that we're heading into a period where there's going to be a very rewarding opportunity on the purchasing side. Now, it may not be, you know, in terms of investment in housing, it may not, you know, pay dividends for a period of years. As I said, we may get a low sometime in a year or so in the housing market, and you may not see a rapid recovery. But in terms of yields, in terms of being able to buy properties that pay you more in rent than you pay out in costs because the prices come down, that could be a very attractive thing potentially by 24, for example. And also on the equity side, you know, if we get an S&P that retrenches its earnings multiple. So, for example, earnings on the S&P is still above $200 in terms of forecast for 23. If we get a typical recessionary move, which is a 20 to 25% correction in earnings, you could get an S&P with a multiple of 12, something like 2200 from 3800 today. And that would be a really attractive opportunity to buy, you know, dividend producing stocks. I use the S&P as an example because it tends to lead the cycle globally, but Canadian dividend paying instruments as well are likely to be quite lucrative and rewarding at that point for the rare people that have the cash and the discipline to redeploy. So I think that's the upside of potentially late 23, early 24. In the meantime, you know, it could be a pretty tough go for the economy and for some people in the employment sector.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us, and the best of the season. Looking forward to talking to you in the new year.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.